Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365 because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
This is the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast. Hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in their mouth.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
Joining me on the podcast this week, if there is a list of the greatest basketball broadcasters of all time,
His name is absolutely on it.
Mike Gorman, in year 37, broadcasting Boston Celtics games. He goes way back to when the Celtics were on something called Prism New England, which I don't recall that network.
It's a group out of Philadelphia, I think, originally. They had something to do with the Hartford Whalers, too. But yeah, we had those terrible lime green jackets. That's what I remember most about it. Tommy looked like a float when he walked in the garden. He would get his attention right away.
37 years, all with Tommy Heinsohn. And I want to get into some of that, but you are a true homegrown guy, Mike. You grew up around here in Dorchester. Full disclosure, Mike grew up with my father in the old neighbors. This was before Dorchester was like this really nice place to go.
That's right.
It's trendy. Now it's like where the college kids go.
It used to be where you identified yourself by parish. Mm-hmm. Where you're from, St. Brendan's. Oh, yep, St. Kevin's. Oh, I knew somebody from St. Mark's, you know. That's the way it was. But yes, you and your dad and I, we were the St. Brendan's crowd. Mm.
You know, growing up, was this an aspiration? Was being in broadcasting an aspiration from an early age?
You know, it'd be nice if I could say yes, but the answer really is no. I really had no idea what I was going to do. I went to Boston Latin School, went to Boston College for a year, tried to play basketball there. Actually, I kind of semi-made the freshman team back in the days when it used to be freshmen weren't eligible to play on the varsity. They had a freshman team, and it was a good freshman team, too. Billy Evans was on that team, who had a cup of coffee in the pros. Terry Driscoll, a great player out of Boston College High, played for the Pistons for a while. So I kind of made the freshman team, but kind of ignored my studies. And so when the end of the first semester came around, ironically enough, the coach of the team was Kuz. And Kuz called me in and said, Michael, you're really not in our future plans and you're not doing very well academically. So actually what Kuz did, which kind of solidified my early ties at the time with the Celtic family, this was before I would ever work for them. Kuz said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I really don't know. And he said, well, you're in trouble academically here at BC. Let me make a call to Lusky over at Boston State Teachers. Would you be interested in going there? I said, I'd be interested in going anywhere right now because I'm trying to keep my 2S deferment because I don't want to get drafted. Mm-hmm. So I go over and see Jim Luskatoff. I remember I left my house in the morning a student at Boston College. I came home that night a student at Boston State College, which I had a little difficult explaining to my parents, but they liked the difference in tuition, so they weren't too bothered by it. Lusky was great. Lusky was like, yeah, sure, come play for us. You won't be eligible for a year. So I worked out with the team for about a year. And then I just kind of lost interest in playing ball. And I remember going to Lusky thinking like, oh, he's going to be really ticked. And he was like, ah, do whatever you want. He didn't care. So, yeah. But I did lose my 2S deferment and ended up going to the military for better part of 7 years after I got out of college. So when I was at Boston State, this is a very long-winded answer to your question.
No, please. That's what podcasts are for.
When I was at Boston State, I started to think, well, maybe I could be a teacher and a coach. You know, I was looking for some way. I want to stay around the game, and the easiest way to stay around the game seemed to be to become a teacher and try to become a basketball coach. But the military kind of interfered, and I went into the Navy originally. I was going to go in for 2.5 years. I ended in there for 7, which is another long story. But when I get out, I had no idea what I was going to do. That's the answer to your question. I had never thought about broadcasting. I had done some. When you're in a squadron in the Navy, you have collateral duties other than the actual flying. You have a ground job. And my ground job was I was the public relations guy, supposedly, for the squadron, which means I had to run these meetings all the time. They were called AOMs, which are all officer meetings. So there'd be about 50 guys at a meeting in a given squadron. And I always, when I was in the audience, I had always found these meetings terribly boring. So I started doing a little bit of stand-up, you know, in front of before the meeting would start. And I found out that I kind of liked the microphone in my hands, and I liked being in front of a crowd. I found it very comfortable, to be honest with you. So when I got out of the Navy, I was trying to think of how I could get a job, and that leads to another long story.
So the idea of getting into broadcasting began then, but you bounced around a little bit early on, all around New England, though, right? You never left the New England area.
I never left New England. I had a great experience. I mean, this is just dumb luck that got me into this. I had been out of the military for about 6 months, and wasn't working. I was just kind of hanging out and wasting away and let my hair grow and had a beard. And my parents were like, you got to get a job. You really got to get a job. You're 27 years old now. So I decided, okay, I'll try to get a job in radio. And just being ignorant about the whole thing, I decided one morning to drive over to WBZ in Boston and see if I could get a job. And so I pulled up at the security gate, and the security guard said to me, you know, who are you looking for? And I said, I want to see Gil Santos. He says, does Gil know you're coming? And I said, no. And he said, well, you just can't wander in here and see Gil, you know. You got to make an appointment. And what do you want to see him about? And I said, well, I want a job. And he said, have you ever done radio and TV? And I said, no. And he said, you can't start at WBZ in Boston. You have to start out somewhere else and work your way back to WBZ. He said, where you been? And I said, I've been in the Navy for the last 7 years. And he said, oh, I was in the Navy, blah, 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 blah. Let me call Gil, see if he'll see you. So he calls Gil. I get in to see Gil because of the Navy connection with the security guard. So I'm sitting there talking to Gil. I give him my little spiel about what I want to do. He picks up the phone. And he goes, Paul, Gil, yeah, how you doing? Good, good. Yeah, I got a guy here who's got 4 years experience in armed forces radio and television. It'd be perfect for you. Yeah, fine. All right, I'll send him down. Bye. Gil, I don't have 4 years experience. He said, don't worry about that. And we needed that to get you in the door. So I show up at WNBH in New Bedford, Massachusetts. This is a true story. I show up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I meet this guy, Paul Levesque, who turned out to be a great friend and a great mentor, who was the sales and general manager of WNBH in New Bedford, which at night, if you drove more than 2 miles away from our tower, you couldn't hear us. During the day, we had about an 8 mile radius in our tower, but we kind of had the city of New Bedford. So I'm talking with Paul, we have lunch, we decide to go out and have a beer, we have a beer over lunch, and he says to me at some point, he said, do you play softball? And I said, yeah. And he said, you any good? And I said, oh, I'm real good. And I was, that was my sport. And I to back up, when you're in the Navy, especially at the time when I was in there were backups in the different stages of flight school that you had to go to. So the backups may be 3 months before you could advance from one stage to the other. And they had nothing for you to do during that 3 months. Right. All you had to do was call in every morning and say you were still alive and you had the rest of the day off. So I started hanging around with some Marines, and I ended up playing on a touring softball team that we toured all through the South and played Army bases, towns, anybody who wanted to play us, we would go play them in these softball games, fast pitch softball. So I was pretty good. So flash forward out to New Bedford, and the guy says, well, we're playing a softball game tonight against our biggest rival in town, the other radio station, because there's only two radio stations in New Bedford. And it's all for charity. Would you come and play? And I said, sure. So I went and I played. I got up 4 times, hit 4 home runs. I mean, it was really a different level than what I had been playing. And so at midnight that night, I got the job as the public affairs director of WNBH Radio in New Bedford.
And all because of softball.
And all, God bless him, all because of Gil Santos picking up the phone and calling this guy and saying, you know, lying to him to get me in the door. And, you know, by the time the softball game was, I think it was about 10, 11 o'clock at night, and we were on our, like, 19th beer. And I remember Levesque saying to me, like, you have no Armed Forces radio experience, do you? And I said, no, I don't have any. He said, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about it.
I'm always, you know, using Brad Stevens for an example, about, I'm always interested about the path not taken. And Brad's often told me about, you know, almost being a pharmaceutical rep and staying there and before getting into coaching. Did you have one of those moments where it could have gone a different direction, where you might have gone and done something else?
Yeah, it's interesting you would say a pharmaceutical rep, because I took an interview with a guy who was representing Becton and Dickinson, I think their name was, their medical instrument company, and it was a sales job to sell medical instruments. And this guy sat opposite me and told me for 20 minutes how I need to get excited about forceps and things like this. And I was just...
Were you?
Yeah. No.
No.
So I'm sitting there all the time thinking, wow, this isn't going to work. I think it was like 2 days later, I drove into the WBZ parking lot thinking, at least I got to try to get a job that I like as opposed to just get a job. But yeah, at the time, I guess I was a fairly desirable quantity because I was 27 years old and had 6 years' experience as a naval officer, and I wasn't just getting out of college. But, you know, packing a bunch of medical instruments in the back of my car and driving around to hospitals and trying to pitch doctors was not really what I wanted to do. So that's why I went to WNBH in New Bedford. I was only there for about 15 months. That's another, I mean, again, it's all luck. This kid, Mark Haynes, who later was an anchor at NBC and was the morning squawk box anchor for a long time when MSNBC, CNBC rather, first came on the air. Mark has since passed away, but Mark was the news director of WPRO Radio in Providence. He was driving to the Cape one day, and he flipped on the air, and he heard me on the air, and he called me up. This is a good story. He called me up, and he said, do you want to be our Massachusetts, our New England reporter? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And he said, okay, you can start next week. And I said, well, I got to get out of my job. And he goes, no, you don't get out of your job. You're just doing this for us on the side of the job you already have. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to rip the AP wire every morning, and if there's a fire in Worcester, Massachusetts, I want you to read the AP wire, and at the end, I want you to say, in Worcester, I'm Mike Gorman for WPRO News. And then if there's a fire in Portland, Maine, I want you to read the whole story, and I want you to say, in Portland, Maine, I'm Mike Gorman for WPRO News. And I said, yeah, but I won't be there. And I remember this long silence on the phone. He goes, you're not getting this. And I was like, oh, you just want me to say I'm there. He said, you say I'm there. He said, you do that for 6 months, and I guarantee you the program director here at WPRO will be so impressed with who you are, he'll offer you a job. Because you're just obviously going all over the place, doing all these stringer reports. Mm. Took 3 months. And program director called me in, was like, you're amazing, you're everywhere, every morning I listen to you here, there. I said, well, I spent a lot of time in my car.
Not submitting expense reports as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I got the job as the public affairs director at WPRO Radio, and did that for about 3 months. At radio stations, you have a commitment you have to make each month to public affairs programming. Usually it's the stuff, if you find yourself in the car at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning and you try to find something on the radio, you can't because it's all this public affairs programming. That's where they bury it all. So I had to do these interviews every week. And then after a while, I kind of got the people to do the interviews themselves, so they didn't need me. And I used to hang around with this guy, Mark, and Mark was like, we got to get you on the morning doing sports. So one morning, he just said, we got a new feature here. Mike Gorman's going to do sports at 20 after the hour, 20 off the hour. So I started doing that, and I got along really well with a guy named Salty Brine, who was an institution in Rhode Island.
That's a great name.
It's a great name, isn't it?
Especially for Rhode Island.
Yeah, Salty Brine. He used to run a kid's show, and he had a collie named Jeff that used to sit there and used to be... brush your teeth and say your prayers was what he said at the end of every show. And everybody in Rhode Island, anybody in Rhode Island who's listening to this podcast right now who's over the age of like 50 is going like, yeah, I remember Salty. I remember Salty. So Salty did the morning show, and Salty owned mornings. And like he got ridiculous numbers. He got like 52s, 53s in the morning. It just, no radio station could compete with him. And he took a liking to me, and my one-minute sports reports became two-minute sports reports, became 3-minute sports reports, and why don't you hang around, Mike, after this after Dancing Queen, you know, whatever we were playing at that hour of the morning, and we'll talk about something else. And I eventually kind of merged after about a year into being his co-host on the air. And he was the one who orchestrated the whole thing. He liked me. We did get along well in the air. He was kind of like the older the guy. I'll tell you, this is my best New Bedford story, Providence story. I have the job for about 3 weeks, maybe a month, and I'm living in Bristol, Rhode Island. And I'm out the night before in Newport, and I ended up spending the night in Newport and woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm supposed to be on the air, and I'm in Newport. And I'm like, geez, this is, you know. So I run out and I jump my car, and at the time I had an MG convertible. So, and the top was still down from the day before. So like I'm coming up, it's like half raining, and I'm just trying to drive from Newport. And this is long before the days of cell phones or anything else, but Salty says on the air, he comes on the air at 6 o'clock. He goes, Mike's not here. I wonder where Mike is, you know. And he goes, Mike's driving an MG. If anybody spots him on the highway, flash your headlights at him, okay? So I'm driving along, and all of a sudden, like, headlights are being flashed at me all over the place. And I get there at, like, 10 minutes to 7. So I'm an hour late for the shift on the air. And I get in and on the air. And about 8 o'clock, the secretary for the general manager of the station comes up to me during a break, and she goes, Dick would like to see you after you get off the air. It's the end of my job here in Providence. I'm back in New Bedford if I can. I'm lucky. So I go in to see this guy, Dick, the general manager, and I'm standing there, and he's on the phone. He just waves for me to sit down, and he gets off the phone, and he says, how much leeway do we have on these podcasts for language?
Oh, we get plenty. Yeah, okay. We get plenty.
He looks at me, and he goes, this late shit is good. Keep it up. So now I'm thinking, like, wow, I got a four-hour-a-day job where they're encouraging me to be late.
Because of the reaction
because
that, Salty,
the reaction
can,
that
okay.
Salty did in the people. Because
it becomes content.
Yeah, it became content. It became like, where's Mike in the morning? Okay. So I became kind of like Waldo for a while. It was like, where's Mike?
Where did Mike wake up today? Yeah, what's,
exactly,
what's he driving in?
What's okay. he driving today? Anybody with him?
So when does this, how does this all lead to Boston? How does this all lead to the Celtics? I know you and Tommy, you've credited Tommy a lot with your early stages of working together.
So I'm in Providence now for maybe better part of a year, and we get URI basketball, get the radio rights to it. And they had a pretty good team. Sly Williams was on that team. They had G. Williamson. They had some really good players, and we're playing a pretty big-time schedule at the time at Maryland, played a lot of good games. So I did the games for a year on radio. And to back up a little bit, when I was in New Bedford, they told me, like, I said, I want to do play-by-play. They said, you sell it, you can do it. I don't care what you sell, you can do it. So I sold boxing, I sold high school football, high school basketball, high school baseball, Southeastern Massachusetts University basketball.
Two advertisers, you're saying?
Yes,
okay, so you went out and
I would go basically buy 2 hours of time from WNBH, which you could get for not much. And I would go out and then sell against that thing. And then I would go do the games myself, just like we're doing this podcast with my own equipment, go set it up with a microphone and go do the games. So I had some experience, and now I'm in Rhode Island, and we get URI, they're pretty good. And Dave Gavitt hears me and says, would you be interested in doing some stuff with Providence? And I said, yeah, what do you think? He said, well, our TV rights are up, we're about to go to Channel 12. Maybe we can figure a way that you can do the games on Channel 12. Well, and again, this sounds like I'm making this up, but I'm not. In the interim between having that conversation with Dave and the games actually starting, the weekend guy at Channel 12 leaves abruptly. And I get a call from the TV manager on Channel 12 saying, would you be interested in auditioning for the job? So I audition for the weekend job, and I get it. A week after I get it, the Monday through Friday guy abruptly leaves and goes to Orlando. So now I'm on 7 nights a week, 6 and 11, on Channel 12. I'm doing it all. And I'm doing this for maybe 2 or 3 months. So I become really visible in the Rhode Island marketplace. We negotiate and get the rights to Providence College basketball for like 5 games. We're going to televise on Channel 12. I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and they're debating who they want to use for color. And I said, we should get Tommy Heinsohn. They go like, Tommy Heinsohn would never want to do this. And I said, well, and you'll get a kick out of this. I said, let's give it a try. So I call the Celtic offices and I say, can I have Tom Heinsohn's phone number? And they go, yes, it's 617, which would never happen today, right?
Oh, no.
You have to go through 9 layers of people. They give me Tom's phone number. I call Tom, introduce myself to him on the phone, and Tommy's like, sure, I'd love to do those games. You know. So Tommy and I end up doing 5 Providence College games 1 year, then we did 5 Providence College games the next year, and that's when he told me about Prism. and that the Celtics were about to get involved. And nobody was involved in pay cable. That was unheard of. And it was, let's go really back to the dark ages here now. But nobody had really heard of pay cable, so that was all brand new. And people saying, nobody's going to pay money to really watch games and blah, blah, blah. But they had, Prism had got the rights. Prism had decided to do it. Prism hired Tommy, and Tommy basically facilitated things. Tommy and a guy named Bob Caporal, who was a wonderful friend, who was a lawyer at the time, working on some other projects with the Prism people. And between he and Tommy, they hired me. And I think I worked the first 17 years on one-year contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, I always thought I was going to lose my job at the end of the year.
But you had Tommy, who you clearly had a strong relationship.
Corner. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't put into words the relationship I have with Tommy Heinsohn. We've been together for 37 years doing the Celtics, 2 more years of doing college basketball, so 40 years we've been together. We like each other. I think we understand properly who's who in the relationship, who the expert is, who the mechanic is. And I'm the expert, he's the mechanic.
Clearly.
Tommy and I just have, from the very beginning, I mean, I've told this story many times. The very first game we did was Holy Cross and Providence at Holy Cross. And I've got my notes all spread out in front of me, and it's the first college game I'm doing on TV. And I've got 14 different color codes. I've got names of the players, how many people are in their family, those sidebar stories, what their major is, who they like, what their favorite, you know, all this baloney I have. So I have it spread out in front of me, and Tommy comes in the booth, and he looks at it. He says, "What's that shit?" And I said, "Those are my notes." And he reaches down, and he crumples them up, and he throws them off the balcony that we're working. And he goes, "We don't need those. We're going to talk about what we see in front of us right now." And that's how we have done games for 37 years.
Did you know doing those Providence games that it would be a good sometimes you, when you work with somebody, it's not always, you're not always in sync. You're not always on the same page. Yeah. Did you know during those Providence games that it was going to work?
Yeah, I did, really. Again, because, you know, I grew up in Dorchester, as we touched on early. And, you know, me and my buddies, we used to take the train in and climb up the fire escape on the side of the old Boston Garden. And you get to the second floor and you'd bang on the door. And one or two things was going to happen. Either
I feel like I've heard a story like that before. I feel like in my own.
Either a cop or an usher was going to come, and you're going to have to run. But usually, 75% of the time, somebody sitting in the second balcony came up and opened the door to see what the racket was. And you would make your way in. And you'd sit in the second balcony for the first quarter. You'd get to the first balcony in the second quarter. And by the fourth quarter rolled around, you would grab those two seats you saw were empty for the three quarters from upstairs down the corner of the bench. And I saw a lot of games that way. And you're too young to remember any of this, but your dad was certainly would. They used to have NBA doubleheaders. You know, so you could go see the Pistons play the Bulls and then the Celtics play the Sixers and the same night. And then for when I was in high school, the last 2 years in high school, I worked on the Bull game. So that was, the Bull game was the best. You would come in, they'd pay you like $30 or $40 to watch the Bruins play, then put the floor down and watch the Celtics play, and then take the floor back up for the next Bruins game.
I didn't know you were part of the Bull game back then. Okay.
Yeah. I loved doing that. That was great. That was stealing. That was the first time I said, wow, you can actually get paid for being in the building. That's a good deal.
What, you know, the amount of time you and Tommy have been together, any real disagreements between the two of you over all those years?
Yeah, we had a, and I can respond so quickly to that because there's only been one. We had a very loud verbal argument in a restaurant in Orlando. I don't know how many years ago it was. It has to be 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And it was a little bit about our roles getting confused, and he thought I was doing too much analysis, and I thought he was doing too much talking, period. We had to be kind of separated at a table in a restaurant in Orlando, which was funny because we were both too old to be having that kind of a scene. But by the time the game rolled around that night, we had kissed and made up. And, you know, we're just friends. He's like my uncle. He's like my older brother. He's Tommy. And I know him well, and he knows me well. And I think neither one of us really liked the experience in Orlando when we thought back on it. You know, we had kind of like the perfect relationship, and we had messed it up for a short period of time. And a short period of time, I mean 7 or 8 hours. Mm-hmm. But no, Tommy's the best. He's the best.
When people that are younger listening to this don't really remember, you were working with Kuzi too for a long time as part of a three-man booth there.
Yeah, we did with Kuz for a while. I'll never forget working a game with Kuz in Atlanta where late in the year where I tossed him. I said, Bob, what about tonight's game? And he went, Michael, these are two teams going absolutely nowhere. I'm thinking, oh, Bob, can you hear the clicks right now? As the people turn this off. But Kuz, God bless Kuz. Kuz, you're always getting the straight shot from Kuz. Mm-hmm. He's not going to sugarcoat anything. Mm-hmm. We didn't do too many three-man broadcasts. The first, I don't know what it was, maybe 15 years, 16 years that I did the Celtics, I just did the home games. And I went and did the Big East mm-hmm. when they were doing the radio games. And that day were Bob and Tom. And early on, Red. Then it was just like three guys at a bar. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no play-by-play. There was no commercial reads. It was like they talked over the action. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to be sitting with three guys at a bar, who better than Tom Heinz and Bob Cousy and Red Auerbach? So nobody complained.
I've had this conversation with guys like Marv Albert, Mike Breen, as well about, you know, where kind of signature calls come from, whether it's, you know, bang for Marv or Mike Breen, yes for Marv. You've got a couple that you kind of go to on a big shot, whether it's just a straight yeah or a got it. I mean, is there, what's the genesis and how much did you think about what to say in those types of moments?
Got it. Well, I knew you had to have some sort of signature, not signature call, but you had to have something that you were comfortable with for big moments. And I remember talking to Johnny Most about it. When I first got the job, again, I was fortunate because Johnny could have really stonewalled me, you know. But Johnny never had any desire to be the television guy. He was very happy being the radio guy. He could smoke, he could eat, he could do all the stuff he wanted to do while he was...
Sometimes in real time on the air. Sometimes exactly. I remember some of those early games.
So John was very, very helpful to me. And so the very first games I did, I remember meeting Tommy and saying, I want to meet you in the press room because I don't know anybody in the press room. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll meet you in there. And so he met me right away and he said, let's go sit with Johnny Most. So then I got introduced to Johnny Most. And Johnny was like, you know, tried to coach me right away, tried to mentor me right away. He was just delightful. And he said, you got to come up with some sort of signature call. And he said, I want you in the next couple of weeks to give me three or four examples of it and I'll tell you what we think is good. And that's where Got It came from. You know, he had got it. He heard me do that. He said, stick with that. That's good. That's got potential. So, I mean, I don't know if I was the first one to say got it. Sometimes I feel like I've been the last one to say it.
Do you have a favorite Johnny Most story? Because he was traveling with you guys, right, back then? I mean,
yeah, he was. It's not so much a favorite story in that there's any punchline to it, but those were the days of the coffee shops in the hotel. And John lived in them, just absolutely lived in them. We would arrive, check into a hotel. Within 15 minutes, he was in the coffee shop. And if that was 5 o'clock at night, if you went out to dinner, came back, had a few beers, and were going through the lobby at 11:30, John was still there drinking coffee. And he used to have the Herb Cole, the senator. He used to come by and see him all the time when we were in Milwaukee. He had this long line of celebrities, politicians who really liked him who would come meet him in these coffee shops. So I would jump into occasional slide, pull up a chair and sit and listen to him talk. But no, I don't have a particular Johnny Most story. Nothing about like the earpiece being in his ear for a year or dentures flying out when he was...
Could Johnny Most have been hired in today's day and age? I mean, could that voice...
That's a great question.
...be hired?
That's a great question. Probably not. I don't think I could be hired probably today.
No,
Boston accent. I mean, I've tried to fight that for a while. Then I said, like, I'm not going to fight who I am. I heard enough guys on the air that, you know, tell me Tim Brando doesn't have an accent.
Right.
You know? And Timmy's a good friend of mine. To go back to John and the signature call, I kind of got it and I ran with it. Occasionally you try to throw something else in to be different, but when the game's on the line, that's the call that I'll probably resort to. It says it all and it allows me to shut up. I firmly believe less is better in terms of broadcasting. Sometimes to the point that my producer will say, like, he's still alive out there. You all right? And that means like he wants me to talk more. But
especially in those big moments, right? You know, you kind of want to let those breathe as much as
you can. And so to say, once it got it, and then let it go. And Tommy's great. Tommy doesn't try to jump in. Scal's new. He occasionally sticks his foot in where he might be better off to let it play. But Scal's going to be very good. Scal really wants to learn, and he's going to be very good.
Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping in America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this. They are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120 sleep night trial to ensure perfection and 120 night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow.
The shot or the moment that resonates with you the strongest, because so many you've seen all those championships over the years, but was there one moment that stands out more than others?
Yeah, well, Bird stealing the Isaiah inbounds pass probably does. Mostly because, and the Celtics obviously had greater moments and won championships, but we were never involved in those broadcasts. You know, we used to be able to get through the second round, and now with the new contract in the NBA, the locals can only do the first round of the playoffs, and then they're through. So my highlights are limited to earlier rounds. My biggest possible highlight was my wife was in Europe. She wasn't my wife at the time. I was trying to get her to be my wife. She was in Europe and was coming back through Boston and was going to meet me, and we were going to discuss our future because she had been at a scholarship post-college in Europe for a year. And she was flying home the day we were playing a game, a Sunday afternoon in Boston, and the game went to overtime. And I'm like, this is 30 years ago. There's no cell phone, there's nothing. So she's got to come out at the airport, she's going to get off the plane and go through the gate, and there's going to be no Michael, and there's going to be no Michael to find, and then she's going to get on a plane to Pittsburgh, and I'm never going to see her again. And Larry hit a fall-away jump, ridiculous fall-away jump shot to beat Portland right at the buzzer at the end of the first overtime. And I can remember literally just taking my headsets off after I was kind of like, got it. Celtics win. I took the headsets off, pointed to Tommy. I said, you got this. I ran down, got my car, drove over the airport. Like, it was like The Graduate. Like, I pulled up, I double parked in front. I walked into Terminal E over there where all the international flights come from, and she's coming through the door as I walked in.
Just in time.
And she never left. That was 30 years ago. We've been married 30 years.
You know, that you mentioned the Isaiah steal, and Johnny's call almost has become synonymous with it.
Yes.
You know, that was... Yeah, you think about that play, you also think there's a steal, but that's...
Yeah. Probably some of the best calls I ever had, didn't have anything to do with the Celtics, were in college basketball games. I did the Santa Clara, Arizona game when Steve Nash was a freshman and they were 15, they beat it 2. Vanderbilt lost to a directional school, I forget who they were now. I did that game in the NCAA tournament that was just came right down to the final 5 minutes with like a heavyweight fight. Everybody made basket after basket after basket. I did a lot of Big East tournament games in Madison Square Garden that were very memorable. I did some Georgetown Syracuse games in the Carrier Dome with like 30,000 people there. Most of the bigger moments that I really had broadcasting were in college games, mm-hmm. Because of the fact that the NBA wouldn't let us do it.
So you came in with the Celtics, and right around the time this young kid from Indiana is making his way.
Oh, I thought it was going to be easy. They had like 2 championships and an appearance in the final in the first like 4 years I'm there. I'm thinking like, this is great. Then we go like 18 years or whatever without anything.
What were your early memories of Bird, though?
Just his focus, his concentration. He used to walk into the old garden, and he used to have those rampways because of the circus. So you'd walk up the ramps back and forth to get in. And I can remember coming in at like 3:30 in the afternoon for games at 7:30. And as I walked up the ramp, the sound of a ball hitting the court would get louder and louder. And you'd get to the top and you'd look down, and there was Bird with Corky, who was his guy. Mm-hmm. And just Kyrie like is like this a little bit. Bird was down there, and Bird wasn't like standing outside the three-point line practicing 33s. He was practicing little jump hooks in the lane, little finger rolls off to the left and right, little left-handed shots. And then you'd see him do it during the game, and you know, people at home were going like, how did he make that up? Well, he didn't make it up. He had been working on that. He knew exactly where he was going to use it. There are two guys that I've seen in my career that completely dominated the moment, and that would be Bird and Garnett, and were dominant teammates, the ultimate teammates. They made everybody better all the time, not just on the court, off the court, when you're traveling, when you're doing things. And Bird, Kevin more so much when on the outside, but Bird on the court was such a leader, and was, you know, as soon as he stepped across the lines, he was playing. And everybody uses those analogies, like everybody else was playing checkers, he was playing chess and all that stuff, but it's true. Larry was a Phi Beta Kappa in basketball. I knew what he was in the rest of his life. I didn't get to know him that well. I wish I had got to know those guys better. I know Kevin McHale a little bit, but I wish I had got to know those guys better. But because I wasn't doing the road games, as you know, that's where you really meet guys. That's where you get to start a relationship with a guy that isn't based on asking him a question about the last 5 minutes of tonight's game. So having never traveled with those guys, I never was really that close to those guys. I was much, much closer to the Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett team. Mm-hmm. They're my favorite team of all time, as much as that's heresy to a lot of the Larry Bird folks. They're my favorite team. And Paul, without question, is my favorite player.
What do you remember, though, about when you have that many stars kind of put together, Hall of Famers put together in that 80s era, I mean, how functional were they? Did they like each other? Did they get along? I mean,
yeah, they did. They did, because Kevin was outspoken and funny. Chief was just willing to go along. Danny was Danny. Even back then, he was Danny. He was always kind of pushing people, prodding people a little bit, trying to hustle you into some game he knew he could beat you at. And, you know, it was a very different scene, because instead of the comfort with which these guys travel nowadays on these 757s that are all decked out in first class with beds in them and everything else, you were traveling commercially, and you had to, you know, you had back-to-backs, and you had to get up and be on the first flight out the next morning. So, you know, I get these things now where it says, you know, bags and bus at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. You had to be on the first flight out. So, bags and bus was like at 4 after you had played the night before to go and play again somewhere that night. Mm-hmm. So I can remember they used to send ML Carr out first off the plane, because again, the media would be waiting, and there's no security in those days, so the media could come right to the gate where you were landing, and they would send ML out first, and he was supposed to engage all the reporters, and then Larry and Kevin would try to sneak by in the back and get out and get into the bus as fast as they could. I think it was much harder on them. Much harder on them in the sense that they didn't get a chance. They didn't have a nutritionist trying to work out their food menu for them. They weren't buffets waiting for them on the plane. There were a lot of potato chip bags and Cokes and guys who smoked. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very different atmosphere. But again, if I have one regret from all those years, it's I wish I could have got to know them better, because I would literally arrive at the Garden, I would go to the press room, I would sit down with Johnny and Tommy, and we would talk about the game, and then Tommy would say, come on, let's go see Red, and we'd go down to Red's office, and I would sit there and never say a word, and Red would proceed to talk for 20 minutes about what was going to happen tonight, and who was good and who was bad, and then we'd go out and do the game, and as soon as the game was over, I'd walk downstairs, get in my car, and go home. Mm-hmm. So I had no contact with them. Again, you tend to occasionally go to shoot-arounds or practices when you're on the road. When you're at home, if you don't have to go, you don't go. Mm-hmm. They were more strangers to me, even though I did all those games. They were more strangers to me. And I think, in one level, I remember talking in a broadcasting class about this, it made me a better broadcaster, because I didn't know them. And so they were all heroes to me. You know, Larry Bird was Larry Bird. Kevin McHale was Kevin McHale. They were great players that I was getting a chance to call play. They weren't the guy who stiffed me last night, who I either liked or didn't like. The hardest thing when you're doing play-by-play is to not cover up for guys you like when they make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I always felt I was pretty objective doing those guys, much more so than I was during the Pierce years, because I just really liked Paul, and so Paul made a bad pass, it usually was because the other guy was in the wrong position.
You know who doesn't get a lot of credit for those 80s teams, though? Casey Jones.
Yes.
You know, and one of the most impressive resumes of anyone incredible, in basketball
incredible
history.
Incredible resume. Going from the University of San Francisco and a couple of championships to an Olympic gold medal to coming here and winning like seven or eight championships in a row. And a remarkably sweet man.
Mm. Why was he the right guy for those teams when you think back on how he coached them? Or could anybody have coached those teams?
I don't know whether anybody could have coached those teams. I think because there were so many strong egos there. He didn't try to be the guy. He didn't try to make his personality bigger than the players, and I think that helped a lot. I remember being in a game in Utah, and Larry had something like 25 points, 12 rebounds, 11 assists, and eight blocks or nine blocks or steals, I forget what the fourth category was, but he was like one away, whatever it was. So there's about 5 minutes left in the game, and Casey takes Larry out, and Casey comes walking by the table, we're going to climb out, and I give him a little wave. And I said, look, Larry's one steal away from like a quadruple double. That's kind of unheard of, you know, in case you just want to know. So Casey says, oh, that's pretty cool. So I see him walk up and say something to Larry, and he goes back and sits on the bench. Larry never gets back in the game. And so I see Casey afterwards, and I say, what happened with what the quadruple-double? And he said, oh, I told him. He just looked at me, and he said, I've done enough blank and damage around here tonight.
Sounds like Larry.
Yeah, exactly. But it also sounds like Casey. Casey wasn't going to say, oh, get back in there. Casey was like, that's the way you want to do it. There's another famous story, which I'm sure is probably half true, of Casey diagramming a play at a key time in a big playoff game, and all of a sudden a towel flying into the middle of his diagram, and it was Larry, and he looked up at Larry, and Larry said, give me the blanking ball. And Casey said, looked at the other guys and went, give him the blanking ball. And that was the end of the timeout. They gave it to Larry. He went 1-1, won the game, and that was the end of that.
So much stuff that happened. Could you imagine stuff like that happening today? Like
no.
In today's media culture, like Bird threw towel at coach.
No, that would be the end.
Coach suspended for two games.
That's right. That 5,000 questions, 2 weeks later, people are going, I know this was 2 weeks ago, coach, but what did you think when you saw the towel? I'm always amazed watching Brad and watching Doc, who was a master at it, but watching them handle these pregame press conferences, not so much the postgame, because that's usually focused on what just happened, but the pregame press conferences, and you have media there who haven't seen the Celtics in 3 months, and they want to know, you know, what did you think of Marcus Smart breaking his hand? You know, well, that was a while ago. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought all about it. Now it's gone. So I'm amazed how these guys handle that.
Some coaches don't. Like Stan Van Gundy is not going to.
Pop.
Yeah, Pop won't answer that
Pop's
at all.
Classic. Although Pop's mellowed out lately.
I always thought that Pop, his rep was undeserved to some degree. He didn't want to do the in-game interviews, and that became kind of a bit for him to some degree. But if you asked him a real question after a game, he was phenomenal.
Yes.
Like he will not, if you say talk about something, he's not going to.
No.
He's going to say talk about what? Or if you say how important.
As a reporter, you should be thrown out of the press conference if you open up with talk about.
Yeah. Or if you say how important, he'll say very, and that'll be the end of
right.
it. Yeah. But if you say, you know, noticed LaMarcus Aldridge playing more through this spot, is that by design, and he thinks it's interesting, he'll fill up your notebook. He's excellent like that.
Oh no, Pop's the best. Pop's one of my favorite coaches of all time. Not for his political views.
He's got some interesting ones there. Two tragedies that befell the franchise during your time broadcast. One was Len Bias in the 80s, and of course Reggie Lewis passing away in the 90s. What do you view as the most consequential for the course of the franchise, Len passing or Reggie's passing?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that question. My first reaction would be to say Bias, because there were people at the time who thought he was better than Jordan, and had more size, had a chance to be a lifetime player. Reggie was a wonderful player, and the whole Northeastern thing made it even more special. But Bias could have been a LeBron type of player at the time, so I thought the fact that radically changed our direction for quite some period of time, as I remember correctly, they got no compensation from the NBA for it. It wasn't like, well, we'll give you the number one pick next year. They were kind of like, too bad, Boston. And so that was, I would say, that was more consequential to the franchise. Reggie's passing was more emotional. We didn't know Len Bias. We only knew what Len Bias might be and could be to help us be a better basketball team. Everybody knew Reggie and everybody loved Reggie. So emotionally, that was much more devastating. But on the court, I probably would have said Bias.
Try to think about, again, fast forwarding it almost to today, about what how a situation like Reggie's would unfold in today's sort of climate. I have a hard time seeing, well, he didn't die during a game, of course. He died practicing, but you know, the NBA would never have allowed Reggie to play in today's league. Same way Chris Bosh is now pretty much out for medical reasons there. I mean, people kind of forget, some, those that weren't around when that was happening, how crazy that was. I mean, you had a dream team of doctors saying, don't do it. One doctor saying it's okay. And, you know, lo and behold, what happened there. So
hard to talk about.
Yeah, very hard to talk about. You are... With the team now, there's a former college coach who's having great success. Brad Stevens considered one of the best coaches in today, you know, bar none of a lot of them.
I buy that.
Yeah, I buy it too. I think he's an incredibly good coach. Mm-hmm. You were around when Pitino was here, though. And Pitino came in with a lot of fanfare. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a great college coach coming out of Kentucky. He coached his first few years basically with the core of his Kentucky teams. I mean, there was Antoine and Walter and Tony Delk and all those guys. From what you saw, why didn't Rick Pitino work as a pro coach?
In Boston, I think the answer to that is I think Rick got some bad advice from people coming in here saying that he had to be in charge of everything, because if he wasn't in charge of everything, that there were people here who would, I don't know, stab him in the back. I don't know what the argument was, but Rick was told by people, the way I understood it, that he had to have full control or this wouldn't be the job to take. So as a result of taking full control, he took the president's title away from Red, which was... Just way off on the wrong foot. And it just kind of went downhill from there. Rick's basketball credentials are impeccable. And I go back to Rick being an assistant coach at Syracuse and his first stint through Providence. I got to see him up close. And you knew this guy was going somewhere because he just was so intense on what he was doing and had really good ideas. In college, especially, embraced the three-point line when everybody else was saying this is bad for the game, and Rolly Massimino was refusing to take three-point shots because that was bad for the game, and Rick's making 12 of them with guys like Pop Lewis and the guys you never heard of going to the Final Four. There's no question Rick is a brilliant basketball guy. I just think he was given the wrong information as to how he needed to operate here in Boston, and I think his plate became too much of what he controlled. He controlled everything. And it just turned out to be too great a load. And I do think the pro game, being a great, we know this, I'm not stating something that I think is remarkable here, but being a great pro coach, college coach, doesn't mean you're going to be a great pro coach. In fact, it probably means you're not going to be. And so Rick was one of the few guys who I think could have succeeded on both levels really well, if he had let other people run the business and other people do stuff. He just should have taken control of basketball operations and nothing else. Instead, he tried to take control of the whole franchise, and it just didn't work. People remember, Rick saying, Robert Parrish, Larry Bird not coming through that door. That wasn't really the problem. The problem was more taking on too much to begin with and then not being able to do what you wanted to do best.
And taking Red's title was astonishing. Even at the age I was at around then, still working for the team, that you would take Red Auerbach's title from him, even if he's chairman at that point, put it upstairs to some degree. That's not a good way to start your career in this.
No, it just was wrong. I mean, it was bad advice, and it could have been rectified pretty quickly. It wasn't. And it just proceeded to get worse, and Rick became an island. It was really not. I can remember very clearly in Miami watching Rick on the sidelines, and Paul Pierce coming out of the game, and watching Rick the way he embraced Pierce as he came out of the game. I remember I was doing the game with Tommy and Bob both, and I remember turning to them during a timeout, and I said, "He's done. He's not coming back." And they're like, you're crazy. I said, trust me, I can tell. I've been around this guy for a long time. He's done. And I remember going to the locker room afterwards and going in, and it was dead silent. Couldn't have found Jeff Twiss, and I said, "Where's Coach?" And they said, "He's in a room over there." And I went over and I knocked on the door, and his voice said, "Come in." And I walked in, and I sat there with him for about 2 minutes, and he just said to me, "I'm not going back. I'm done." And I said, "Is there anything I can do for you outside in terms of how do you want to handle the media or whatever?" And he said, "I'll figure that out, but I'm done." And I just said, "Good luck." I remember walking
out. What do you think broke him?
No one thing, just accumulation of a lot of things, being unable to make the system work the way he wanted it to work. I think, with a lot of college coaches, they can threaten minutes with guys. That's the big hammer to motivate guys. You can't do that in the pros. You know, Paul Pierce and Antoine Walker are going to play their amount of minutes. Doesn't matter what you say or what you do. So I think he had lost those guys. You know, they'd probably be polite to the state and say he hadn't, but from where I sat, he had lost most of the guys on the team, and he knew it. Mm. You know, so sometimes you see, you know, I look at the Pistons in some clubs that we were playing lately, and I'm saying, like, wow, there's a gap there between the bench and the actual players. And I just, you know, again, Rick just didn't have control of the team. They didn't want to do what he wanted to do anymore. And didn't believe in him. That's to get to a more positive subject, but that's the great thing about Brad is these guys all believe in Brad. They believe that when he draws up a play, they really think it's going to work. And you know, you constantly hear these guys that have come through here in the time, especially in the early years when Brad had a lot of guys going through. When they'd go through their exit interview and to a man, they would say, "I'm a better player now than I was when I got here." That wasn't the case with Rick's guys. Guys were getting worse. They weren't getting better.
Mm-hmm. Along those same lines, Danny Ainge has emerged one of the better GMs in the league. You know, covering him, you know, back in his playing days and after that. Did you have any inkling then that he might turn out to be this impressive, this good as a GM?
I didn't, but I'm impressed. I mean, he really is really, really good at what he does. Which doesn't surprise me, because we could be talking about anything right now, and Danny was going to be good at it. I mean, Danny was good at everything. He was
baseball,
football. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people say he was one of the best high school quarterbacks they ever saw. Danny is really good at everything he does. I can remember when he was named the job, and Red had this way of at least with me, where he would be talking to you, but he wouldn't be looking at you. But when he wanted you to make sure you were really listening, he kind of locked you in with a stare. And I remember when he was describing Danny, and he said, "Danny's this, Danny's this, Danny's this." And then he looks at me and he goes, "And that son of a gun is lucky." And I'll never forget that, because Red was like, "You got to have luck. You got to have luck." So Red certainly recognized what Danny could be. I wonder whether Danny is so good now. You would know this much better than I. But if he's so good now, do people want to deal with him? Are they afraid to deal with him? Because everybody who deals with him seems to ultimately come out not only on the short end, on the real short end.
I think there's a mix of it. I think some of the new guys are a little gun-shy about making a deal, whereas some of the older guys want to be the one that beats him on a deal to some degree.
So I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true. And I... You know, the thing I see with a lot of GMs, I shouldn't say a lot, but it seems obvious to me with some GMs, is they're afraid to make deals. They would rather go into the season with what they have, and then if all else fails, you fire the coach. Mm-hmm. And then you get your second go-around at it, as opposed to where Danny is taking a team that's, 41-19 or whatever the Celtics are right now, and you know Danny's on the phone with somebody trying to make this team better. That's probably the most fun aspect of working for the Celtics all these years, is they want to win the whole thing. They don't want to get in the playoffs. They don't want to say, "Oh, we got to the second round." That there was never been, even when they were bad enough to only get to the second round, there was a belief that somehow maybe this will be a miracle and we could win it. And so working for a franchise that is always trying to win the whole thing, as opposed to just try to be better than the next guy, is part of the reason I've stayed here as long as I have, because it just is, it's so much fun to watch them do it. That was a long drought in the 90s, but to watch them come back and see what the position Danny's put them in now, where this team's going to be good for a long time. Win championships, we'll see. That comes down to a lot of things. But are they in the hunt? Are they in the conversation? Yeah, I would say going forward now, I like with their position better than with Cleveland's position, for instance, in terms of salaries and things coming up. Toronto's very good, but again, any discussion of who's going to represent the East, Boston's prime in that discussion. Right. And that's going to be that way next year and the year after and the year after.
Well, in the 90s, you got to go to Barcelona, right? You were 92, I did get to, Dream Team.
I did get to go with the Dream Team there a little bit. That was fun. That was fun. They really were the Dream Team. I mean, they had their own private bus. They had blocks roped off so people can get near their hotels. I mean, they were like the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. One of the best books I've read in a while was Jack McCallum's Dream Team book, where he basically wrote a chapter on every player on that team. And man, they seemed like they had a good time over there. Like, larger than life isn't even, yeah. I don't even think that's an appropriate phrase to describe it.
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story, because I'm with my future son-in-law and my daughter. And we're talking about Barcelona. This is recently, like a week ago. And I said, do you remember when you took the walk with Charles Barkley? And she said, like, he immediately perked up. She said, did she do what? And I said, we're sitting around a table, and Kristen was 7 years old, 8 years old maybe. And Barkley stood up at the table, and he said, I want to take a walk. Come with me. And he puts his hand out. And Kristen, like, just grabs his hand, and off they go. I'm going, hope this works out well, which it did.
It's just, you don't even know where he's going to be going at that point.
Exactly. But he took her around the block or something like that. People were rushing for autographs. She thought it was really funny, and then he brought her back. And her fiance is just like, you were hanging around with Charles Barkley, and you don't even remember it. She was like, yeah. But, yeah, that Barcelona experience was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I was doing tennis. I could tell you some good tennis stories.
So 37 years, will we see you at 50 years?
No. Mike? You'll see me, I hope.
See you, but yeah.
Hopefully I'll be sitting with Steve Pagliuca down on the baseline. I don't see the end right now. But, you know, I got to give somebody else a chance to do this job eventually. I really would like to, because I think this can happen in the next 3 or 4 years, I'd really like to stay for one more championship. I'll never forget doing the parade from the team and the Pearson Garnett team. So, yeah, one more duck boats ride. Mm-hmm. That'd be good. Then I'm ready to go.
I feel like Tommy
I'm ready to go play golf with your dad.
Yeah, well, he's got plenty of run. I feel like Tommy will find a way to – he always changes schedule every single year. He'll find a way to be doing one game a year until it's till the very end, at least.
He says to me all the time, like we can – we'll just take over that studio show, you and me. We'll just sit there. We'll watch it on TV. We'll have a couple of subs, and then we'll talk about it. We'll go home. It'll be good. I'm like, all right, sounds good to me. People but like, that's not going to happen for a while.
The Tommy Heinsohn meal plan, it cracks me up when I see him in studio. It is subs. It's chocolate milk. It's tremendous. Yeah. He just sort of, and he has that same, I mean, you dealt with it on a much different level, but that same sort of mindset in studio, whereas I'm going to talk about what I see. I'm mm-hmm. not going to go in, you know, prepped for doing this. Mm-hmm. When I see it, well, I'll talk about it.
Well, there was a time, you know, and I used to enjoy doing Big East games because you were literally introducing teams to people. They didn't know who the players were. And players were changing every 2 or 3 years. And so I really like that. But when we get into doing what we're doing, like, people don't want to hear necessarily background information. There's so many places they can go find that. Nobody stumbles upon us. There's like 100, 200, 300 stations on your cable box. Nobody, it used to be there was 4, 5, and 7, and then 38 came along, and that was a big deal. Nobody stumbles on us. People know exactly where we are. They go there to listen to that game that night. They want to know, like, is Marcus Smart back? Is he, okay, that's good to know. How close is Gordon Hayward? Okay, that's good to know. All right, let's go play. So all those biographical stories of, you know, one of 9 kids, his brother does this, his father does that, I just threw all that stuff out about 18 years ago. And I just sit there with Tommy and go, ooh, look at that.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure listening to you, pleasure working with you these last few years, and thanks for joining me here on the podcast. I appreciate it.
St. Brendan's is proud of you, Chris.
Hey. Trying to live up to it. That's it for this week's episode. Thanks to everybody for joining in. Thanks to my guest. And as always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. TNCs apply. Available in app only.